From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
In the tragedy, sometimes in odd places, out of left field, without any clear motive in the play, King Lear talking about how woman is a divided creature like the centaur, that she's heaven from the waist up and hell below.
Welcome to Soundings. Love, gender, and sexuality in the literature of the English Renaissance. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guest is William Carrigan, a professor of English at the University of Maryland. During a recent conference sponsored by the Center on Love and Marriage in the English Renaissance, William Carrigan delivered a paper entitled Virgins and Whores in Shakespeare. Tell me about some of the assumptions that a Renaissance poet or writer, for example, Donne or Shakespeare, might have made about women, looking at women. Does it have to be this extreme of the virgin and the whore?
Well, in the Renaissance, there's a widespread expression among poets. I'm not a social historian, so I'm only speaking about the poetry here. A widespread expression of sexual disillusionment. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if there's a fundamental design flaw in the creation of male sexuality. One of the most common complaints is that the object of desire, once possessed, loses its value, becomes debased, and hence desire has a self-destructive quality. Mm-hmm. Once you achieve your desire, possess it, it ceases to be valuable. Mm. One interesting sexual expression of this is postcoital depression, which Shakespeare wrote about in an infamous sonnet, number 129, The Expense of Spirit and a Waste of Shame. Donne wrote about in A Farewell to Love. Ben Jonson translated a Latin poem thought to be by Petronius. The translation opens, doing of filthy pleasure is, in short, once done, we repent us of the sport. Uh-huh. These three poems, all written on the lip of the 17th century, inspired later on in the century an entire libertine genre called the anti-fruition poems, written by Suckling, I guess, are the most famous. Suckling's poems were answered by a poet named Henry Bold. Cooley and Randolph and other poets contributed to this genre. They're poems in which, because of this failing in the design of male sexuality, these poets recommend infinite foreplay and not consummation on hedonistic grounds.
Because here they're gonna come away with this negative view of woman, the object possessed, and therefore somehow
an object possessed is an object devalued. Sullied. Hence, to retain the value of the woman, one should stop short of consummation. It's an interesting genre. It scrambles the deep structure of Renaissance verse in a way, because here you have poets on libertine grounds, that is, for hedonistic reasons, reinventing the forbidding Petrarch and mistress.
That is to say, the woman,
the unobtainable ideal.
The woman on the pedestal.
And indeed, the last of these poems is the Earl of Rochester's. It's called The Platonic Lady, and spoken by a woman who's giving instructions to her male lover that she will grant him any favor whatsoever short of consummation.
Well, that's depressing in itself to think about.
Well, Jonson's poem, the Renaissance is very practical. They didn't like these problems any more than we do. Today we have gurus and experts and all kinds of products that are intended to solve this failing in the design of male sexuality. And the Renaissance, too, had its suggestions. Jonson, for example, recommended the act of kissing. kissing, unlike intercourse, is infinitely renewable. It's the most innocent of sexual acts. We don't feel shameful afterwards. And in fact, kisses figure very prominently and memorably in some of Johnson's lyrics. Leave a kiss but in the cup and I'll not look for wine is perhaps mm-hmm. the most famous line. But this engendered, again, as the 17th century went on, and it engendered an entire flood of kissing lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that the poetry of the 17th century, which is normally thought of as a kind of Ovidian antipathy to the earlier Petrarchan poetry about unconsummated love, a threshold is crossed at the beginning of the 17th century, then you have this Ovidian period of a poetry of sexual consummation, is in fact characterized by a sort of melancholy despair at sexual consummation, mm-hmm. and some of the old moral disapproval of love that inhabited the earlier Petrarchan literature reappears in libertine settings mm-hmm. in 17th century verse, so that mm-hmm. there is, I think, a profound continuity between the Petrarchan phase of English love poetry in the 16th century and the more Ovidian phase mm-hmm. later on in the 17th century. I mentioned these lyrics of post-coital depression, sometimes rendered rather savagely, nowhere more so than in Shakespeare's 129.
Are they seen as attacks on women, or are they seen of expressions of this, sense of sorrow and depression in the male psyche about what you call the split? Having possessed a woman mm-hmm. is what, to disrespect her or somehow or other not? One of the operative words in this conference that you're attending is friendship. You can't be friends. You can't be have an asexual or an unsexual intimate relationship. Are we on the right track there?
Yeah. Well, in the anti-fruition poems, it is sometimes recognized that it's male desire itself that creates this debasement or devaluing in the woman who's been mm-hmm. possessed. Though in Shakespearean drama, of course, the woman herself is sometimes represented as the motivator mm-hmm. for this debasement or devaluing.
Well, blaming the victim. Is that what we've got?
Blaming the victim,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, how do the women respond, Wally Kerrigan? I mean, do we have evidence in the literature of the Renaissance that women in any fashion literarily, philosophically, somehow or other said, okay, the problem is in the male psyche, and here's how we can solve it? Are we simply looking at the problem of the way men look at women, or are we leaving something out of the equation here?
Well, there's a speech in Shakespeare's Cymbeline about the infection of male doubt, mm-hmm. the man's tendency to question the chastity of any woman he's associated with, whether mm-hmm. it's his wife or later on in Shakespeare in the romances, the daughter.
Or his mother.
Or his mother, indeed, in Hamlet.
Yeah.
And I suspect that women in the Renaissance must have recognized that men do tend to be pathologically suspicious uh-huh. of women.
Insecure is another word.
Insecure would be another word.
Uh-huh.
I have the suspicion that this pronounced concern with this confession of this testimony too that we have in Renaissance literature, male postcoital depression, is of some historical interest. Toward the end of the century, Dryden translates a beautiful passage from Lucretius. It's not found in all editions of Dryden. Sometimes you get a little footnote saying it was not fit to print.
Uh-huh.
But it's a passage about the vanity of intercourse. Two young lovers make love, their limbs entwine, they try to achieve union, the classical vision of the hermaphrodite from Plato's Symposium.
Looking for
all lovers desire right. oneness with their partner.
Soulmate.
And yet, once it's over, they're abruptly thrown back into the same old solitude.
Uh-huh.
And this has something to do, I think, with the postcoital depression, the sense that when intercourse is over, its fundamental fantasy, that is fusion, turns out to be a cheat.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are, depleted, emptied, and alone.
Mm-hmm.
Milton defines marriage in his divorce tracts as essentially spiritual partnership. And there are, in those prose works of his, searing descriptions of loveless intercourse. The ultimate horror of a bad marriage for Milton is making love to the spouse while feeling totally solitary.
Well, having sex as opposed to making love.
Feeling utterly alone in that act, which should be a physical embodiment of mm-hmm. the spiritual partnership mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. is marriage, in his view. When Milton comes in Paradise Lost to imagine heavenly sexuality, he inverts the usual cosmic placement of the sexual life. You know, usually the demons in hell engage in all kinds of sexual orgiastic perversions while the angels are chaste and sing in the choir and so forth. Milton's devils are denied sexuality.
Huh.
They pine in vain desire, whereas the angels do perform the sexual act, and Adam asks his angelic visitor how they do it in heaven.
Mm-hmm. And what's the answer?
Well, the angel blushes celestial rosy red. And to set this up, Adam has suggested that there might be two ways that you do it in heaven. Do you do it by looks only
uh-huh.
or by touch, immediate or virtual? And uh-huh. what he seems to have in mind is that they might do it just by looking at each other. They might do it by mixing their auras or radiances, or they might actually touch each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the most extreme form of sexual expression he can imagine is the earthly one, which is a friction of surfaces. They might touch each other.
Mm-hmm.
The angel's reply is that Adam has a limited and earthly sexual imagination, because the way angels actually do it is that they mingle totally.
Mm-hmm. They become one.
Without joint or membrane, they become literally one. So mm-hmm. that sexual intercourse, as Milton imagines it, at its most sublime, at its most perfected form, is proof against this solitude, which is the source of melancholy mm-hmm. in the earthly sexual act, mm-hmm. okay?
Why am I thinking of Northern California in the 1980s all of a sudden, and talk of the self-help movement instead of John Milton?
Well, I want to throw another bend in here so you'll be thinking about something else. I think that 150 years later in the Romantic period, the fundamental male sexual anxiety is no longer that the fantasies of fusion might be a cheat and we'll wind up thrown back into our customary solitude. The fundamental fear is that fusion might take place. As you have, the sexual life is being inhabited by metaphors of vampirism uh-huh. and mesmerism.
Loss of
hypnotizing. The loss of autonomy
right.
becomes the fundamental anxiety or dread that inhabits representations of sexuality. Whereas in the Renaissance, that is precisely what is desired most, the fusion, and the actual sexual act is depreciated because it doesn't fulfill that desire,
uh-huh.
and you're thrown back on loneliness. And I suspect that where we're at today in the history of male sexuality is that there's a good bit of denied and suppressed hostility toward women.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about love, gender, and sexuality in the literature of the English Renaissance. My guest is William Carrigan of the University of Maryland. During a recent conference sponsored by the Center on love and marriage in the English Renaissance, William Carrigan delivered a paper entitled Virgins and Whores in Shakespeare. Among the focal points of our conversation was the response of contemporary feminism to Renaissance conceptions of love and sexuality. Here is William Carrigan.
I think that feminism, this is not to judge it or not to say anything about it, simply to make a historical observation. I think that feminism fit into a traditional female gender trait, namely piety.
Uh-huh.
That women had been trained, particularly in the 19th century, to represent religion in the family, to represent a kind of righteousness. The man went off into the world of money, where he did somewhat shady things in order to keep the family going. But when it came to spiritual and religious values, the woman had a kind of pure embodiment of them.
Indeed.
Along comes feminism, and insofar as feminism allows a woman to view history as her victimization, to view history as something that's been done to her,
mm-hmm.
and to launch, therefore, an extraordinarily powerful indictment against the other sex, it fits into, it's coincident with this tradition of righteousness,
mm-hmm.
or piety. And indeed, feminist discourse has this immense moral authority, such that most men listening to it would not think of questioning it, contradicting it, saying in public, at least, that it's wrong.
Mm-hmm. All right, and are you doing that?
I would like at least to engage in a dialogue,
to
treat feminism as something that's so pure and so righteous that it's untouchable,
mm-hmm.
that it can't be dealt with or negotiated about, seems to me to be a mistake that isn't good for feminism.
But the feminists, Wally Kerrigan, aren't saying that all men are bad, all men are ill-intentioned, all men are making of women victims, are they? That sounds too monolithic.
Certainly there's a touchiness in feminist discourse about any attempt by a man to define female experience, to think that he knows what female experience is, to
uh-huh.
think he really does know what the grudges are here or what's at stake in this conversation.
Uh-huh.
One of the complaints, after all, is that the very notion of woman has been a male definition imposed on women throughout history. Hence, mm-hmm. to say something back to feminist discourse is oftentimes to be attacked for continuing this tradition of trying to define the woman. I think that in this early polemical phase of feminist criticism, it was necessary to take, let's say, the most misogynist writers,
uh-huh.
Strindberg, even Shakespeare, and put them in their place, to brand them for what they are. Sadly, though, sometimes the implication of this is that now these authors are well understood. We need not seek wisdom in them uh-huh. anymore.
Kick them out of the canon.
Or just recognize them as artifacts of a certain patriarchal sensibility that's hopefully on its way out.
Uh-huh.
It would seem to me that if it's historically important just now to understand what it is in men that has victimized women
mm-hmm.
through history, that writers like Strindberg and Shakespeare would become suddenly precious
Very
to us,
important.
Because we're more likely to figure it out
sure.
reading these figures than we are taking some sort of, you know, common sense, you know, whatever happens to be on the grapevine today, opinion of
mm-hmm.
why men do this.
All right, well, let's pursue that a little bit,
okay.
Wally Kerrigan. We're talking about male as much as female sexuality, and we brought the conversation for a few minutes here into the 1980s. Let's go back to your field of expertise, the English Renaissance. What can we learn about human sexuality by looking at the sonnets of Shakespeare or his plays? There are a number of directions you could go in. You talk, for instance, about moving from the histories into the tragedies, into the romances and comedies and all of that. Is there a pattern there that has a gender dimension to it?
I think that there is a tremendous rage against women that powers Shakespeare's tragedies in particular.
Mm-hmm.
The first text in which one sees this seemed to me to be the sonnets. Whenever they were written, I take them to be earlier than the tragedies. I guess that's debatable.
Uh-huh.
But the sonnets end in an indictment, an extraordinary indictment against this dark lady who has betrayed her husband, betrayed Shakespeare, betrayed the man whom Shakespeare vested in ideal garments
uh-huh.
at the beginning of the sequence. And In the tragedy, sometimes in odd places, out of left field, without any clear motive in the play.
Zing comes a shot at a woman.
Zing comes King Lear talking about how a woman is a divided creature like the centaur, that she's heaven from the waist up and hell below.
Uh-huh. Where does he move beyond that? Does he get optimistic, as it were?
No. He winds up raging at the stench of it.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of misogynist passages in Renaissance literature, but I can't think of a single other place, certainly in English literature of the period, where the vagina is figured as hell.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty serious theological business.
You can hardly write a more
powerfully negative trope about.
Where does Shakespeare move beyond that? Does he become optimistic about human sexuality? The larger question, Wally Kerrigan, is: can we read Shakespeare and learn good, healthy things about sex? In the sense that we might have a consensus between the feminists and what do we call them? The non-feminists, not the men necessarily, but seeking this integrated vision of gender and sexuality.
Of course. In Othello, just to look at it in very simple terms, I don't think I'm appealing to a very complex psychological schema here.
Mm-hmm.
You have a play in which the author is permitted in the creation of Iago and in the gradual decline of Othello to express all kinds of misogynist rage, ultimately mm-hmm. to write a murder in which a woman is strangled, while all the time waiting in the wings is the innocence of Desdemona to indict the very rage that's being expressed in the play. Clearly this indicates, if I'm right in my simple psychological assessment of what's going on in that play, some sort of conflict and a desire to be free from this rage.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to me, as it seemed to many Shakespeare scholars, that it's in the romances finally that Shakespeare is able to overcome this, and he does it not in the figure of the wife or the sexual partner, but in the figure of the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The betrothed daughter, who a virgin on the threshold of the sexual life, the father in particular having to overcome a certain cranky reluctance to allow this woman to have another man.
You'd be talking about Prospero and Miranda.
Primarily.
For example.
Sure.
All right. So we can read a play like that and, stretch the leap a little bit and really find something out about ourselves sexually.
Well, everybody knows that the relationship between the suitor and the father-in-law or prospective father-in-law is a touchy relationship.
Indeed.
Indeed. And Shakespeare, if you view the entirety of his career, he shows you the experience of life, beginning from being a son through being a husband and finally to being a father and a prospective father-in-law, that lies behind that crankiness.
Mm-hmm.
And to see just a little chunk of our experience within the entirety of a life cycle is a very powerful and humanizing vision, I think.
Wally Kerrigan, we've been talking about love, friendship, marriage, sexuality, apropos of a conference here at the Humanities Center. We've been looking principally at Shakespeare. Let me invite you to conclude our conversation. Think about this for me. You say in the paper that you gave that marriage is the main test of the dualism that you began our conversation describing, this sort of fractured view on the part of men about women. Why do you cite marriage in those terms?
Because it's in the context of marriage that a man, if he is to be happy, is forced to fuse the figure of ideal love with the figure of sexual desire.
Uh-huh.
If he can't, it's going to express itself in some expectable bifurcation of sexual interests. He's going to visit prostitutes. He's going to have a mistress. He's going to have to establish some other figure in his life to be the fulfillment of his sexual desires if he can't mate those desires with the love he bears his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And in adolescence, of course, the split between the respectable woman and the sexually desirable woman is most pronounced. Anyone who's ever been to high school realizes that social life in all its mores in a high school is absolutely governed by this split and this conflict. It is particularly pronounced and acute in adolescence. The next stage in the sexual life of a man is courtship and marriage. It's there, as I say, in the circle of a marriage and a family that this split is either healed or not healed.
Mm-hmm. Given this this what sort of continuum that we have discussed, sexuality, male sexuality, our starting point has been the Renaissance and Shakespeare, moving into the 1980s. Again, should we be optimistic? Are we maturing sexually? Are we coming to terms, men with themselves and men with women?
I'm a fairly conservative person in some ways, and I feel that the tradition of Western thought and culture that I inherit and that I try to interpret my little piece of does indeed bear wisdom. Mm-hmm. And I think of one of the supreme creations of this tradition as being Christian marriage, or shall we say marriage as it emerges from the Bible and becomes embodied in our culture. And the wisdom of marriage understood psychologically from the point of view of a man is precisely this opportunity to heal once and for all this fracturing in male desire and in the love life of men. I think marriage has been understood this way as it's represented in Shakespeare. At the end of my paper, I even appeal to so unlikely a figure as Immanuel Kant, who understands marriage as being the one sphere in which the sexual desire can be lawfully fulfilled, in other words, in which sex and morality can be fused, which is not unlike what I've been talking about.
Sounds like St. Paul.
I think that Freud, another great wise figure in our tradition, understood marriage in this way. And this understanding, the psychological understanding of the stakes that are involved in marriage for a man, seems to me one of the ways that I've found of freshening the inherited wisdom of Western tradition and making sense out of the idea that marriage was a damn powerful creation and something that's valuable and something that ought to be passed on, newly understood, to the future.
William Kerrigan is a professor of English at the University of Maryland. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Love and Sexuality in the Literature of the English Renaissance, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be marriage and the family in late medieval and early modern European culture. My guests will be Lawrence Stone of Princeton University and Michael Screech of Oxford University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a conversation about love, gender, and sexuality in English Renaissance literature. Wayne's guest is William Kerrigan of the University of Maryland. Arguing for an integrated vision of woman, Kerrigan says that men have trouble getting love and desire to mate in their souls. The tyranny of sex. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.